unless it's an act of jihad.
Yeah.
And so unless they can figure out a way, I'm sure they could launch a jihad to Mars and then it'd all be okay.
Right, right.
But instead, no, if you're Muslim and you follow the general authority of Islamic affairs and endowment in the United Arab Emirates, you cannot go there unless you're going to be coming back.
I know that there was at least 200,000 people that initially applied for this Mars One project. I'm sure there's more than a couple that are Muslim.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I always understood the plan to be that, you know, they basically shoot a rocket up there first, like a couple of years earlier than anybody else. And they like help build little compartments, do some terraforming, essentially, give them a living quarters before they shoot the people up there.
So basically send up a 3D printer.
Yeah, sure. You know, they're getting one to almost make pizzas just now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's not suicide. That's living a long life and just probably never being able to come back.
Where it's more likely to be suicide is the radiation exposure on the way there and then the radiation you're exposed to while you're there. If there's no trip back, within 10 or 20 years, you're looking at a really high chance of cancer. And there wouldn't be the infrastructure to treat the cancer.
Okay.
And that would kill you.
I'm sure there's quite a few Bedouins that are Muslim somewhere that don't get fucking treatment for cancer either.
But they're not going out of their way to increase their risk.
Yeah. I'm sure... Well, there's so many fucking imams, they can have another ruling by another one to say, oh, this will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Just wait a month.
Yeah, as far as my opinion on it, if you want to go on a guaranteed suicide mission, go for it. But you know, as far as the history of space exploration goes, the early stuff has a really high risk of death.
Yeah, but that's not suicide. That is engineers helping to design acceptable risk.
It's higher than typical risk, but I also think that the General Authority of Islamic Affairs and Endowment could better spend their fatwa efforts against people actually going and blowing themselves up.
Wouldn't that be a nice thought? Yeah, but it's not like any of these countries that are producing fatwas like this are going to be sending a team up there themselves.
Mm-mm.
Man, nope. What a chance to learn, and they're trying to deny their believers that.
All right, let's move on to a happier one.
Yeah.
Fusion has been successfully done.
Mm-hmm.
The Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, under the guidance of researcher Omar Hurricane.
Love that name.
Yeah. Has been working on fusion, and it's been very, very expensive up to this point. Well, they zapped their hydrogen target with a very high-powered laser, and they got more energy out of the fusion than they put into it. This and is a first.
That's been the problem up until now is, you know, they can get some power back out, but never enough to make it worth the input that they're putting in.
Mm-hmm.
So fucking A, this is amazing news.
Now, before you get too excited about it, only about 1% of the energy of the laser actually went into the fuel.
Hmm.
The other 99% was wasted. But that still is huge. If they can start scaling it up, they can create a sustained fusion reaction. And at that point, you actually have something working, something usable. It is because, you know, as it stands, this is the first time that we've successfully gotten more energy out of it without having a uncontrollable explosion.
So, of course, this is in the 5 to 10 plus, 20 plus years away from being sustainable and easily used, but fucking A, go
it's
science.
Finally a step in the right direction.
And this might not even be the right step, but at least
it's progress.
Yeah.
Moving on. For the longest time, people have thought that their dogs understood their emotions, noticed their behavior change based on the emotion of the people around them, it seemed like man's best friend understood us. Well, now they have actually gotten dogs into an MRI. It took some pretty extensive training to get them to be able to hold still long enough. And it being a total of 11 dogs and 22 humans involved in this this study in Budapest, where they're exposed to 22 sounds. The sounds they were exposed to were a combination of environmental noises like car sounds and whistles, human sounds, but no human words, and dog vocalizations like barking and growling. And both humans and dogs were given the same sounds to listen to. And the part of the brain that was activated had previously been thought to be unique to humans. But no, it was the same thing activated in the dogs.
Fucking A.
And what's even more interesting is the dogs reacted more strongly to canine sounds than human sounds.
Hmm.
And they paid more attention to the environmental sounds than humans did. Half of the auditory cortex in dogs were activated listening to, say, traffic sounds, but only 3% for humans.
Wow.
Which either means they're less hardwired to process human sounds, or that we're more inclined to process human vocalizations and disregard everything else.
Hmm.
And so what they're interested in now is with the... Well, what they wrote about this from the evolutionary perspective is, although parallel evolution cannot be excluded, our findings suggest that voice areas may have a more ancient evolutionary origin than previously known. Humans and dogs have been kind of co-evolving for the last 20 to 30,000 years, but being able to process that level of emotion is something that more likely came from a common ancestor between us, which would mean it's been in mammals for more than 100 million years.
Damn. Well, it sounds like I got nothing. Oh, poor little dog in the on the table, mm-hmm. all strapped. Hmm.
Yeah. And I was hoping Bucky, my girlfriend's dog, was going to be in here for this part, but he left right about the time we started recording.
Well, it makes sense to me that dogs would pay attention more to their senses than, like, thought processing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
And when their senses are most definitely hearing, so I don't see why that's a big surprise. But yeah, it's cool to see that their brains light up like that.
It's not surprising, but the evidence wasn't there to support it.
I'm betting nobody's just really ever sat down to do the testing.
No, they haven't. And yeah. So now what will be more interesting is, since this is the first time anybody's actually shipped brain scans on, at least at this level, for non-primates, what will be interesting is to find out what else processes emotion.
Yeah.
Do mice? Strap it in. Do birds? Do lizards? Let's find out.
Yeah, let's strap it in, see what happens.
The whole training aspect might make it more difficult to be able to go through an MRI, because you need to have an alert brain, so you can't just...
Gas them.
You can't gas them, you can't tranquilize them, and need them to hold still, so that's going to definitely limit what they can do. But moving along, the remains of a Clovis boy from 12,600 years ago, buried in Montana... they found some DNA in him and have found out that his people, based on the shared DNA, between him and, other modern Native Americans, that modern Native Americans are actually descended from the Clovis culture.
To a large extent, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is a second, group that split off from them earlier. That lives on in Canada and Greenland. But what's even more interesting is this ended up being very difficult from a legal standpoint.
Well, to actually who owns the bones?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, after the testing was done, as I recall, the bones were buried back the way they were found anyways.
They were buried according to the requests of the local tribes.
Yeah, they were, reburied.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So, kind of put back where he was.
Mm-hmm.
So, still, hey, fucking A. I guess the Clovis didn't just die off. They just kind of morphed into, me and bunches of other people.
Yeah.
All right.
Actually, what? No, he hasn't been buried yet.
No?
He hasn't been reburied because the tribes haven't agreed on where or how to rebury him.
Oh, goodness.
So, it's expected to take place in the spring after the ground thaws.
put him back where he was found.
Well, he was dug up because I think it was a farm. They're building there and came across the bones. So they can't put him right back where he was found, but they could at least get him close. Or I wouldn't be surprised if the tribes hash it out and the Crow Nation, who's taking the lead role on this, ends up just taking him and burying him on their reservation. And that's it for science.
Did you know you can stream Atheist Nomads directly to your Apple, Android, and Kindle Fire mobile devices? Add us to your playlist on Stitcher and stream us today.
It's time for politics and religion. And we're going to start out with a couple cases. Actually, all this first quite a bit, both in the U.S. and around the world, ends up all just being about gay rights.
Okay.
And this first bit is actually, after this first one, it's all bad. The Arizona legislature passed Senate Bill 1062, which would have allowed discriminating against anyone based on your religious beliefs. In particular, this was going to be allowing for people to discriminate against the LGBT community. And the impetus for this was for cases like the baker in Portland that denied a gay couple a cake because they were gay, claiming it was for religious grounds. And the couple took them to court, and the baker lost.
Yay.
And so that's prompted a bunch of bills in a number of places, like Arizona, like one in Idaho that has just been tabled, actually withdrawn by the sponsor indefinitely. But once this got passed and the governor was considering what to do about it, the backlash, it was just amazing. Major corporations came out against it. We're talking about Apple, who has recently announced plans to build a huge manufacturing plant in Mesa. American and Delta Airlines, Marriott Hotels, Intel, PetSmart, Yelp, Major League Baseball.
Fucking NFL for the Super Bowl.
Yep. Lots of big business came out against this. The responses from George Takei and Dan Savage, two of the most well-known, outspoken gay men out there, were spot on that if you make it okay to discriminate, like Arizona found out when they refused to recognize Martin Luther King Jr. Day, people won't want to go to your state. Businesses won't want to open up there. There's already been a number of businesses that were looking to relocate to Arizona that changed their plans and picked a different spot because of this. It's been pretty interesting to watch. And Governor Brewer backed down, and she vetoed the bill, saying that it could result in unintended and negative consequences.
Yeah, no shit, Sherlock. It shouldn't have ever had to get this fucking far. I mean, this is just bringing back Jim Crow laws, if it would have passed.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck?
And I have to say, it's really sad that big businesses are the ones that are siding with equal rights and protection, not the frickin' government. Businesses have found that not discriminating is good for business. That it's good for their employees, it's good for their customers, and it makes everybody happier. And the government can't see that in a lot of cases. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. Now moving to Capitol Hill, Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Mike Lee of Utah, two Tea Party jackasses, have introduced a state marriage defense act, which would prohibit the federal government from recognizing same-sex couples' marriages if they live in a state that doesn't recognize them. They're trying to work around the Supreme Court's overturning of part of the Defense of Marriage Act last year, which then caused the Obama administration to take a look at what was going on and recognize any same-sex marriages that were performed in a place where it was legal. Which is a very reasonable standard considering the fact that there are a wide variety of standards as to what counts as a opposite sex marriage across the various states. We're talking age and degrees of relation. There are states where cousins can marry and states where first and second cousins can't. There are states where you can get married as young as 14 and states where you can't get married until you're 18. But every state, under full faith and credit and various other constitutional guarantees, will recognize any opposite-sex marriage, regardless of whether or not that would have been allowed in the state that the couple now resides in. It shouldn't be treated any different with same-sex marriages.
I got nothing. It's stupid if they try and treat a married person different from state to state.
Yeah. And the states should be recognizing these. One thing I saw recently, and I don't remember which article it was in or who it was that said it, but some conservative saying that he really hopes that when all these cases get to the Supreme Court, they side on states' rights. The conservatives are big fans of the 10th Amendment, which states that all rights not granted to the federal government are reserved to the states or to the people, respectively. They're not big fans of the 14th Amendment, which makes it very clear that everyone should be treated equally, period. And what gets me with all these different cases is the states, the conservatives are backing states' rights. But when it comes to liberty, it needs to be held at the lowest level possible. And that's not the state, that's the individual. If these were libertarians, if the Tea Party was libertarian, they would be backing individual liberty, not states' rights. And individual liberty, putting this decision to the people, means you get to decide what kind of marriage you want to have. If you want to marry someone of the same sex, you can do that. If you want to marry someone from the opposite sex, you can do that.
You know what's not going to be happening? Mothers and sons marrying, or fathers and daughters marrying, or animals, or underage people. You know what? That's still not going to be happening.
No. It's just consenting adults make their decisions.
Yeah, what is so hard to understand about that word, consenting adult, like that phrase, consenting adults. Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling that we're talking, it's fucking 2014. And this is still hard for some people. Some people just still don't get it. Equal rights is equal rights. And consenting adults are consenting adults. And there's no slippery slope if you just stick to consenting adults. All right. So as we addressed last time, based on reporting optimistic but misleading news that I'd come across, Uganda's president has signed the anti-gay bill.
Ooh.
With 14-year prison terms for being caught gay and life in prison for aggravated homosexuality, which includes acts with a minor, a disabled person, or someone infected with HIV.
I wonder if he can shoplift the gay. It's possible. I think you can do that. Then you can be charged with, having the gay.
Now, what's even more disappointing here is he'd backed down on it for a while, waiting for scientists to weigh in. So what was the report he got from his scientists? That homosexual behaviors existed throughout human history, including in Africa. That a singular determination for sexual orientation has not been demonstrated. As a result, many scientists hypothesize that a combination of genetic, hormonal, psychological, environmental, and social factors determine sexual orientation. And that reparative therapies to change people's sexual practices have not proven successful and their scientific validity has remained questionable. That all sounds good and
fairly decent.
Not a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what he was really wanting them to say is it a choice or not? If it's not a choice, then we can't have it be illegal. Granted, it was already illegal. This was just going to be making it more punishable. And so then the scientists went on to just spout off opinion without any backing.
Oh, boy.
With the real key phrase here being, whereas some homosexuals take up the behavior as an open choice, for others it's due to indoctrination. Basically saying, the science isn't in yet, but it looks like it's probably not a choice, but we think it probably is. And so he went with that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Asshole.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Okay.
And while this was all going on in Nigeria, they passed a new anti-gay law, with 10 years in prison for directly or indirectly making a public show of same-sex relationships, or participating in gay clubs or organizations, or supporting them, or leading to international criticism of this law. And as a result of that, it went from a very, very slow trickle of cases of people getting charged with being gay to gobs and gobs of new cases. And for some, I guess, kind of good news, a Ugandan activist and physician who's actually been working in South Africa for a while, helping them with treating AIDS patients, was trying to get back into South Africa, and they weren't going to let him because he had supposedly a lapsed visitor's visa.
Hmm.
Well, he'd been applying for a work permit quite a few times, and those applications just kept getting stalled. Well, while they were holding him, deciding whether to send him back to Uganda or let him in, protest ensued, and South Africa decided to give him a work permit for his exceptional skills and let him into their country.
Oh, hey, cool.
Yeah. The big reason why he was really trying to get into South Africa is he was terrified that he would be targeted if he went home, because he has been a very outspoken critic of this anti-gay law that just went into effect there, where being a critic of the law is against the law. Ah, fucking aggravating. Which brings us to some more directly wacky religious stuff. A woman in Colorado recently put her two-week-old baby on the train tracks in front of a train that was about to take off.
Wow.
When she was arrested for attempted first-degree murder, she claimed that Jesus took the baby from her arms and laid the child on the tracks.
Right.
Yeah. There were witnesses to this happening. People who saw her put the baby on the tracks, and they freaked the fuck out, for good reason. Some of them knocked on the windows for the train and got the train to stop. And then some city workers got to the baby and took it off the tracks and got it into foster care.
Crazy fucking woman.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is not good. No.
Yeah.
I keep saying I got nothing, and this is just a really short article. There really is nothing.
Next, we have former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, of course, Republican from Texas.
Hmm. I wonder if he believes in God or not.
There are so many fucking Republicans in Texas. Anyway,
there's a lot of fucking population in like Austin and San Antonio. I mean, why don't those places have? They're pretty liberal too, from what I've heard. Why don't they fucking get some people in there in the government?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways.
Anyway, he got onto the Global Evangelism Television Network.
Right.
And when the host asked him where the country went wrong, DeLay said, "I think we got off the track when we allowed our government to become a secular government, when we stopped realizing God created this nation, that he wrote the Constitution that is based on biblical principles."
I'm sorry, wait. Did God wrote the Constitution now?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, he thinks God wrote the Constitution, which
from
is...
From his lips to my fingertips.
Yeah, which would explain why the preamble starts with, "We the people of the United States," not "I the Lord your God." Would explain why there's no mention of God in the Constitution, and why the only time religion is even mentioned in the original Constitution is prohibiting a test of religion for public office. Yeah. Fucking crazy. And finally, American Atheists, after a
rather interesting few hours,
they've been approved to have a booth at the American Conservative Union's CPAC, and after a huge outcry from conservatives, we're told, no, actually, American Atheists, you can't have a booth there.
Obviously, they don't see eye to eye on a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm. Dave Silverman, president of American Atheists, told CNN that he had hoped to court many closeted atheists in the ranks of conservatives.
Well, that seems kind of fair. I mean, I'm pretty sure that not every fucking atheist out there is liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure.
Yeah.
There's got to be a couple.
And I saw some exchanges on Twitter. Looks like they will actually be getting a refund on the cost of their booth.
Well, it's only fair. Yeah, I saw something about somebody was saying that American atheists misrepresented themselves. I was like, really? I'm sure everybody in the CPAC has watched, you know, fucking Fox News when David's on and mm-hmm. yelled at the TV. Everybody knows who fucking David Silverman is.
Mm-hmm. And how are you going to misrepresent things with a name like American Atheists?
Yeah.
That seems pretty clear.
Well, it doesn't actually say a political bent of one sort or another.
So. No, it doesn't. But still.
And actually, you know what? American Atheist does have the word American in it. So God bless them.
Yeah.
America.
Well, that's it for news. It's time for the interview.
You've got decisions. This versus that will help you make them. This versus that is an all-new six-hour series that uses science to investigate the world within arm's reach. For instance, what's the fastest way to navigate through highway traffic? Just stay in your lane and creep along, weave in and out of cars, taking advantage of every opening, or is it faster to take surface streets? This versus that will reveal the answer to that question and dozens more. This versus that is the web's number one choice for science enthusiasts, skeptics, and critical thinkers. Go to thisversusthatshow.com. Again, thisversusthatshow.com. This versus that. No bias, no bullshit. Just science, fact, and funny.
Use offer code NOMADS when checking out to save 25% off your purchase at thisversusthatshow.com. That offer code, once again, is NOMADS.
Joining us now is Mohammed Syed and Sadaf. They are co-founders of the Ex-Muslims of North America. Mohammed is based out of Washington, D.C., and Sadaf is in Toronto. Welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So let's start off with the organization you guys run. The Ex-Muslims of North America. What is it? Why did you start it? Why is it important?
So from my perspective, what happens often is a lot of people that leave religion, Islam in particular, tend to be socially isolated, and they're not public about it. There's a lot of fear of retribution, be it social, be it physical abuse. There's a whole spectrum of possibilities. So I knew a few people that were in the closet, and as a result, I wanted to help build a community where people are able to talk about their experiences and stuff. Sadaf, on the other hand, was doing something very similar in Toronto.
Yeah,
and this summer, we connected and started the larger organization. Sadaf, why don't you?
Oh, yeah. Personally, for me, what actually started it was growing up, I had a lot of doubts. Unfortunately, I didn't have anyone to talk to about it. And it's very odd to have that sort of conversation with conservative, Muslim parents. My brothers weren't very practicing, but, I tried reading the Quran growing up, and it wasn't until much later that I read the Hadiths. But regardless, it was last year this time that I found, a community through Reddit, and I realized that there are other people like me, and, they're not, and I realized that they're not just people on the internet, they're people that live in the same city as me. And, there's already a meetup going on for Toronto, and I joined. I showed up one day, it was me and about five other people, and it was amazing to sit there with other people who felt really similar to me about not only just religion, but, our respective cultures. It was really amazing to meet other ex-Muslims, and I started attending, and I think, Mohammed, it's probably similar for you, but it was amazing to start organizing and reaching out to people who otherwise wouldn't have a space for them to come out and actually be themselves.
That sounds really important to be able to have a place, a little corner that you can call your own.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And honestly, for us, They're more than just, there are other overlapping issues. For example, we have a lot of queer people in our group. We have trans people. We're trans friendly. We don't stand for any homophobia, no sexism. These are the sort of things that we try to leave behind us. And we come to this space and, we get to talk about our issues and our experiences, with our communities and their families. I think that's very important.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I'd imagine it's even more important considering how Muslim communities in North America tend to be highly, highly separate from everyone else.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know, Mohammed, if your experience was similar, because, you know, everyone, not everyone's family or community is the same. but as, you know, I have, my parents are Afghan. They immigrated, and it was very traumatic for them to just get up and leave everything behind them and come to Canada. For them, that sort of segregation that you find in immigrant communities, especially, you know, Muslim communities, I find that they're very, parents are very afraid of having their children stray away from the religion and losing their culture, losing their values. And it's almost like a sort of like a survival instinct sort of kicks in. And that's sometimes it really ends up backfiring. And some parents and families, communities take it to an extreme. And I tend to find that a lot. But I guess it depends on every family. So.
That's really sad. I've from the like Hasidic Jews that I've talked to over time, most of them, when they leave it, they still love the tradition and the celebrations, and, you know, they still join their family for that. You know, the families really aren't losing much. They're just not going to worship every week.
So one issue is that from our perspective, they're not losing much, but from their perspective, you're losing everything, because if you stray from this path, your child who you love will burn forever and ever and ever. And the punishments that are described in the Quran are pretty horrific and eternal. So if you actually believe in those and subscribe to those, you're willing to do whatever it takes to save your child's eternal soul.
Yeah. I just add in one of the things my mother told me growing up was that, you know, if Sadaf, if you don't believe in God, if you're not Muslim, like your father, your grandfather, and the, you know, father before him, you know, you'll go to hell, you go into an eternal hell, your skin will burn off, and it'll grow back, and you'll just keep burning off and melting off into this eternal process. And as you can imagine, that's kind of traumatic to a child, hearing to anyone, really, and it's these fear tactics that sort of, that they use to keep you within the religion. It's actually not uncommon. So
wow.
Yeah. That's definitely something that my parents told me growing up.
I've actually heard of there's a lot of churches in the US, Christian churches, that will do these things called hell houses, where basically like during Halloween or some other time of the year, you go through the house and they have plays, and they're all really nasty and torturous and horrible. Have you heard of anything like that?
Well, I mean, like an Islamic perspective, or?
Yeah, yes.
Personally, I haven't.
No, I don't think they have that at the moment. But so one issue is that anything that is identified with the West, or like Halloween is a pagan celebration, Christmas is a pagan or infidel celebration kind of stuff. So it's avoided as much as possible. So that latching on hasn't happened. But the Islamic communities in general are copying tactics used by the Christian community in the West. So I wouldn't be surprised if a few years down the road, stuff like that did start popping up.
That's
that sucks.
Yeah.
That really sucks.
Yeah.
Halloween's just about the candy. Screw them.
So, if you look at the literature behind Islam, like the Quran and Hadith and stuff, it's not young earth. Like creationism exists, but it's not young earth creationists. But due to the fact that they're copying a lot of literature being put out by Christians, there's this strain that has popped up in recent years of young earth creationism in Islam as well. So they are mirroring it a few years behind.
So do Muslims in general believe in an old earth creation?
So specifically the Quran doesn't mention anything about the age. So they're not bound directly to it.
Nice. That's interesting.
But, I think evolution, on the other hand, I think I know a lot of, personally, I know a lot of Muslims who don't believe in evolution. So that's a big no-no.
God directly created Adam. So therefore, obviously, there's no such thing.
Pretty much. We don't come from apes. That's what my father said.
Nice.
So how about your own personal journeys from background in Islam and journey out of it?
Personally, my story, my parents, they're Shia Afghans, which are quite a minority in the country. Growing up, my parents, they're liberal to an extent. I was never forced to wear the hijab. So that was pretty good. My parents actually grew up in the 60s and the 70s, pre, you know, Soviet invasion, and things were a little more progressive at that time. So my parents' family, they were somewhat liberal. And,
I've seen pictures Afghanistan in the 70s with women going to, going to universities, getting PhDs,
wearing regular dresses.
Yeah.
Bell bottoms. My dad had an afro. my mom wore blouses and bell bottoms. Everything was cool. people had Beatles haircuts. Things were fairly liberal. I think with war and poverty, religious fanaticism tends to rise. As my parents came to the country, you know, I was raised, I was born and raised in Montreal, and I came to Ontario, and, religion for me, I just remember going to the mosque with my parents, and, the only time they usually would take me is to the high holidays, which is Muharram, and, which is a very Shia holiday, and, my first experience at the mosque for several years was watching people grieve the death of, Hussein, which is, I think Muhammad's cousin, I believe, Muhammad,
grandson.
It was his grandson. I'm sorry.
Salaf, could you hold on one sec? Let me give you some background. So there's a major schism, which you probably heard of, Sunniism and Shiaism in Islam. Those are two major groups. It happened because Muhammad's grandson was trying to raise an army against another ruler who had usurped the throne, if you would. And Muhammad's grandson was murdered or assassinated. And as a result, there was a split in Islam where the followers that were following the grandson split off. And they're called Shias. And so they have a 10-day mourning every year, 10 to 40 days, called Muharram, which is the most holy period for Shias. The Sunni group, which is, I would say 90% of Muslims, don't subscribe to that view.
Okay.
Thank you for that background.
And the Shia are the only countries with their majority is Iraq and Iran, correct?
Yes.
That's right. So my experience was watching many people stuck in the, obviously segregated with women, the women and children on one room, and, women wailing and crying, and there would be a live feed from the men's side. This is in a mosque in Toronto, by the way. Men beating their chests, and they would actually have any weapons or anything to flagellate, and nothing that you'd see in crazy barbaric things.
So give them some background. They don't know about this.
I'm sorry. where do I explain? Okay. Well, basically, they're grieving, and to feel the pain of Hussein, for example, the grandson having been murdered, what they do is, they beat their chests. Men typically beat their chests. Women are told to cry. It sort of gives them brownie points with God. And that was my experience with religiosity, I think, at a young age. I always found it very odd. I mean, I asked my mom, why is everyone crying? And it's just because, you're supposed to cry. People died, 1400 years ago. And it was a very odd thing that I just couldn't wrap my head around. And religion for me, it was kind of pushed onto me. And my parents tried to enroll me in Arabic Quran classes to learn how to read in Arabic and recite. And that's called Tajweed, I believe. And my parents, no one in my family speaks Arabic. We're Farsi speaking, and I thought I was so stubborn. I didn't want to go and learn Arabic, something that no one speaks in my family, just so I can learn to recite the Quran in a language I don't know.
So another thing that, in Christianity, until a few hundred years ago, the Bible was in Latin, nobody was allowed to translate it, and so on and so forth. Islam had a similar thing where the Quran is supposed to be in Arabic. It's still supposed to be in Arabic. You're allowed to translate it, but they hold the position that you read a translated version, it's not authentic. Like the meanings, it's impossible to actually translate it from their perspective. And therefore, go ahead.
Oh, the Quran is not the Quran unless it's in Arabic.
Exactly.
Correct. Yeah.
So they want kids to recite it in Arabic because you get brownie points from God if you recite in Arabic. But they never actually try to make you learn Arabic. That's very, very rare. So as long as you can read it, you don't need to understand it. That's all you need.
And this is going on in how many different Muslim majority countries where Arabic is not the main language? So imagine that there are so many Muslims out there who read the Quran, but they don't understand what they're reading. And typically they get their, they get context and meaning from mullahs and people from their, you know, preachers at the mosque. That's typically how it usually is. But for me growing up, I actually asked for an English version of the Quran. So I took to reading it as a young kid. I was a really big reader when I was a kid. And I think my first doubts were when I was young and I read how this is probably the best example, which was basically if my parents pass away, the inheritance is split up between me and my siblings. And I have three brothers. So they get an equal share of inheritance, whereas I would get half of what a male sibling would get. So me understanding math and wondering why, you know, complaining why or my brothers would get more than me if they passed away. I asked my parents, you know, why is my brother getting more than me? I don't understand. Aren't we all equal? And one of the explanations my father gave me was, well, you're a woman. When you pass away, what happens is you're going to get married and your husband will have a whole share. You'll have half a share and you get to have some of his share. And growing up later, when I look back on it, it's sort of basically making women seem as if, you know, they're not equal. Two, they have to get married. That means all women have to be heterosexual, which is obviously a big issue. And I think the last thing is, I don't know, it really bothered me the fact that it's not setting up women to be independent people and not be, you know, dependent on, for example, a male.
So if you read a lot of the Islamic literature, it infantilizes women generally.
Mm-hmm.
Women are property. Like the way it's phrased is that a man is in control of a woman or a man is taking care of a woman or a man. So it's never stated as an equal relationship anywhere.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's something you see in verse 434, where basically if a husband and wife say they're in there's a fight, there's a tiff going on. If the wife continually disobeys the husband, he's allowed to beat his wife as if, you know, she were a child. And in some translations, some people will say, well, it means, you know, to beat lightly. So they sort of get away with it. They try to sort of justify it. But, you know, just the fact that you have to lay your hands on someone to get through a problem, which I think no one really agrees on.
One other issue with that often comes up is that, so if you look at modern Islam nowadays, they're actually being criticized for human rights reasons and for other reasons. So they're trying to moderate the message. So if you look at earlier translations and earlier texts, none of them try to play that down. You're allowed to beat your wife. That's it. Modern versions where somebody's translated, they try to hedge their best that strike lightly and things like that, which never existed. It's a new phenomenon. There are lots of things where, so for example, sex slavery is allowed in Islam. You're allowed to have slaves and you're allowed to have sex with them. Muhammad himself had sex slaves. And if you look at any of the older texts, they all list that. They all are unabashed about that.
It's referred to as, you know, what your right hand possesses. So if you see that in the Quran, that's what they're referring to, you know, slaves, which men were allowed to have.
But in modern, if you talk to any, look up modern translations, they try to hedge that, they try to change that. So Muhammad's sex slaves are in modern books listed as his wives. But if you go back to any primary source, they're listed as sex slaves. So suddenly, magically, over the past century, they changed.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Anyway, so as you can see, as I got older, I definitely started to have a lot of issues with this. And I think I was one of the few people who actually read the Quran in English. And most of the people in my community had only read it in Arabic, and they learned how to pray, which I never did because I didn't want to learn Arabic, and I never learned how to pray the proper way, you know, five times a day. And that I think the more and more I got to know about the religion, I got to read it on my own. I did a lot of my own research. I started to step away from it, and it wasn't until I got to university, about 4 or 5 years ago, that I used to pray, I used to meditate, kind of pray, and I felt like I wasn't really talking to anyone. I was talking to myself, And I started to become agnostic. And, you know, as I, you know, I slowly started to let go of the idea that, or the possibility that there might be a God and there's someone out there that has a plan for me. And, you know, I sort of transitioned to being an atheist, and here I am today.
Yay.
And yeah, so it's caused a little trouble in my family. It hasn't been very happy, but you know, my parents have come to accept me. You know, they understand that I know I'm their child. They love me. Thankfully, their love is unconditional. However, for many other people that I've met, especially ever since we started the organization, that has not been the case for everyone, and it's extremely heartbreaking to hear. Many people do find that their parents sort of, you know, pretend that they're dead. Some of them don't talk to their children at all. Mm-hmm. There have been plenty of issues. So that's my story.
Yeah. And you can see that. You see that in all insular communities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But at least of a religious nature.
Absolutely.
It always sucks to see it, though.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely glad your parents are better than their religion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, Mohammed, how about you? What's your coming out story?
So with me, it was more about trying to understand where the religion was coming from. Mm. I grew up somewhat religious. I actually, at one point, used to lead prayers. And a few of my friends, like, I was always relatively liberal, women's rights, human rights, and things of that nature. But a few of my friends after college went super conservative. The people they were hanging out with were... I would say fundamentalist Muslims. And they, so for example, one of my friends, he graduated, did his master's in computer science and got a great job and then quit everything, moved to Pakistan and enrolled in a religious school and was living in a religious school.
Wow.
The last time I met him, I had a conversation with him in which he, and again, this is a very smart person that has a science background, that has a master's in computer science, that is talking to me and telling me that there's this scholar that he knows that presided over the burial ceremony of a Muslim woman whose grave had demons in it because she used to watch television, and television is disapproved by God.
Obviously.
Wow. Holy crap.
So, exactly. So if one of your friends said that to you today, somebody that you knew and trusted and thought was an intelligent person, that would blow your mind that how can this actually happen?
Yeah, just a bit.
Yeah, so at that point,
compartmentalization's key, I think.
So I, at that point, started reading about Islam because my perspective was that something really bad has happened to this person, and I want to show him what Islam actually is. It's not crazy. It's not superstitious nonsense. And the more I read about it, I read the Quran, I read a bunch of associated texts, and the more obvious it was that it is a bunch of superstition. Mm-hmm. So instead of convincing him that he's wrong, I was convinced that that is actually Islam, and I was in the wrong, and it was inevitable after that.
Man.
So one of you just kind of drifted away while the other dug deeper and deeper, and both came to the same conclusion.
That's right. I think quite a few of us have had very similar revelations, I suppose, in our own lives. I think the one thing that I find is that people always tell us, the more you read about it, you think that your religiousness or religiosity would, you know, it would sort of cause a bit of a fervor, but it's, if anything, I feel like it's done the opposite. Reading more about the religion and sitting down and actually taking time to understand it on your own terms.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much
intellectually honest, mm-hmm. and you read about it. It's impossible to actually rationally. So, for example, one of the things the story of Noah, that's a very common story across Abrahamic faiths. I read about it and from an Islamic perspective. And one of the things I did was, what's the volume of the earth itself? And how tall is the highest mountain? And if you want to fill that with water, how much water do you need? And where the hell will that water actually wind up volumetrically?
Totally.
Yeah.
I feel where you're coming from. I remember being that little annoying kid during like Bible study, asking questions just like that and pissing my teachers off.
Yeah. So one of the things is they don't talk about, like, if you tell a child something from a mythological perspective and stuff, they'll accept it. But if they actually tell you the specifics of things, your questions will obviously arise. So another story that I, one of my favorites, if you will, is Muhammad getting on a winged mule similar to Pegasus and flying to heaven to meet God.
Mm-hmm.
and meeting various dead prophets on the way. And this is a very celebrated night, and a lot of the reason Jerusalem is a holy place for Muslims, Muhammad then was never in Jerusalem, is because he flew on his Pegasus to Jerusalem before he flew to meet God. So if you're a thinking person, they're talking about freaking Pegasus.
Yep.
Yeah, a man on a flying horse doesn't quite cut it for me.
A mythical addition to the oral tradition.
Wasn't there something about that Pegasus or that donkey leaving a hoof print on the Alaska mosque?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
That's how mythology is usually built.
Supposedly, it's still there.
Supposedly, Adam's footprint still exists. Supposedly, Adam was 90 feet tall.
Unless you're a good Muslim, you can't check out Alaska Mosque. I tried. Got up there to the grounds around it, and they won't let you in.
Really? Oh, they wouldn't let you in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I could. My name is Muhammad.
Yeah. You, Muhammad, you have a fair chance. My white bread ass has no chance.
You can always convert, change your name. You could try it out.
Okay.
You never know.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man.
I think it's a big validation for a lot of Muslims when other people start converting to their faith. It's so celebrated. It's kind of silly, but but it's true.
So there's this thing where at a mosque, they have this big announcement that somebody has converted to Islam, and there's jubilation and celebration. Like, the greatest thing ever has actually happened.
People heard the truth, and now they're coming to the mosque. I think that's typically what they feel like. So.
The dark converse of that is it doesn't happen as often as America, but we have had a few members that it has happened to, where the mosque announced their apostasy.
Ooh.
And they got death threats and things like that.
Wow.
That is horrible. Man, I can't even fathom that. I mean, that's essentially a death sentence of one sort or another, isn't it? A plain apostasy is of course death, but
which is why so many people are very hesitant of talking about it to anybody. So we've had multiple cases where siblings, like one sibling left religion and didn't tell the other sibling for years, and the other sibling found out years later after leaving themselves, because they were worried about what if my younger or elder sibling will tell the family and what will happen afterwards.
Oh, that is so scary. It's horrible.
I think another reason why I feel that a lot of people are very hesitant to talk about it, it's not just because the fear of disappointing their parents, it's family honor. So if that gets out in the community, it's that family, they're looked down upon, and people will wonder about their parents, what are the parents doing? Do they not raise them right? A lot of things end up falling back on the parents, and that's another reason why a lot of people don't feel like coming out and sharing their apostasy. A lot of people care too much about their families to just be able to say, hey, you know what? I don't think I believe in God. So it's that much of a taboo. It's a really big stigma.
Hmm.
In DC, we had one of the members that, like, the first, this happens frequently, where when we have meetups, people join and they talk about themselves for a little bit before we move on to whatever activity we're doing. And pretty much every meetup, we have one person break down into tears because actually feeling that they're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the guys, he left religion 8 years ago and had nobody he had talked to for 8 years about it. And he came to the meetup and he cried for mid-20s. And he cried for half an hour, and his parents don't know. Nobody in his family knows. And his parents are older and are dependent upon him. He's the primary breadwinner. But he doesn't want to reveal it because the impact it'll have on his parents and his parents' social circle, and how, like, they will kick him out even if they become destitute. And he doesn't want that to happen to his parents, and therefore he's in the closet.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's in D.C.?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
This is going on all over North America. It's not just in D.C. We have very similar people going through the same situations everywhere, even Toronto. Yeah. Yeah, so it's nice to be able to have that space for them. That's just another thing.
How many cities do you guys have groups in?
We're close to a dozen at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically try to consolidate a city and then move on to another city. So we're trying to grow city by city.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Anything on the West Coast?
We had our first meetup in San Francisco recently. We're going to start working on Los Angeles and Portland next.
Oh, sweet.
I think Seattle was also on the list. It'd be awesome. Yeah.
That's up in my neck of the woods.
Oh, great.
Give us a little time and we will be there.
Just don't forget about Boise.
All right.
Yeah,
all
right. That's a little different nut to crack.
We talked about a little bit about that on the podcast-a-thon, but do you want to go into why?
Sure. So the thing is that everybody's family is different. Everybody's culture is different. So within the ex-Muslims of North America, we have like 30 different countries represented. And even within a specific country, like I'm from Pakistan originally, there's a huge disparity between liberal and conservative. What we've experienced is Somali culture is generally very, very conservative. So whenever you have a large community of a conservative culture, the dangers are amplified. Mm-hmm. So what we've experienced is in cities where there's a significant Somali population, the people have been very hesitant to come out and talk to us and organize in any way, shape, or form. So we often, like, if we're doing a meetup, we do it in a public location, a safe area, and it's completely private and secret. Nobody knows about it except the people that are attending that are ex-Muslims. Mm-hmm. But despite that, people were worried that somebody will see me at this cafe and they may link me to somebody else and that may come back to my parents or my family and there may be violence enacted on me and therefore I cannot come.
Ooh, so the paranoia pretty much runs deep, I think.
And with especially the Somalis in Boise, they are as different as possible every single way you think about it from the rest of the community here. Yeah. There's also Bosnian... both refugees and just immigrants here, which most of them would be Muslim, but they just blend right in with the rest of society.
Yeah.
Right.
The Somalis don't.
So one aspect of that is like generally some cultures, like Bosnia, for example, do not view the West negatively. So it's just another culture and they have some similarities, some differences, and we all get along. We're all people and it's all good. In contrast, some people will view it with suspicion and negativity, and therefore they do not want their families or their children or their social structure to be associated with it in any way. And that is often the case with Somali communities.
Okay. And is that more so than people from other countries?
It varies. So growing up, I had always thought Pakistanis were very conservative, but from what I've seen, Somalis are more conservative. On the other hand, you have Lebanese that are far more liberal than Pakistanis are. But even within Lebanon, for example, like we have a member, I don't know, you probably have heard of her blog, Between a Veil and a Dark Place, Marwa Bero. So she's from Lebanon and she went through horrible things at the hands of her family. And despite being from Lebanon, so even within liberal countries, you have a wide strain of where people exist. You can have very, very conservative and you can have people that are indistinguishable from a Western society.
I remember something you were mentioning on the secular.fm podcast-a-thon, again, bringing it up, that should put this, trying to put this into perspective, that like Christians have their conservatives, but our Christian conservatives are more like your moderate Muslims, aren't they?
I would say Christian conservatives are more like liberal Muslims. How many, again, you'd be better informed on that, would, like, Ken Ham kind of people would be moderate Muslim. And I don't think conservative Christians are, like, most conservative Christians would embrace somebody like that.
That's more fundamentalist.
Moderate Muslims and even most liberal Muslims will say that the Quran is the literal word of God. Whatever is written in the Quran is the truth. So they will have, where the Quran says go and forth and kill all the polytheists, they will not say that this is wrong. They will say that this was for that specific era and instance, as if that makes it okay to kill them.
Right.
Man, oh man.
But at least they don't go out and kill all the polytheists today.
Sure.
They don't. Thankfully, they still abide by the laws here, at least. So.
You know what? There's actually a big rise in polytheism, like the old Roman gods, Greek gods. So maybe there'll be a rise in killing polytheists. We'll see.
What, like in Battlestar? I was hoping something like that would happen. That would be something I'd buy. So.
Poseidon and Zeus and Athena.
I remember Sam Harris talking about, like, in one of his talks, he had mentioned, like, how stupid it would be if somebody was trying to defend Poseidon. And he got hate mail for that, like, because there are people that actually believe in Poseidon.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the classes I had in the seminary was a seminar in Gnosticism. And this was, you know, a Christian heresy that by and large was completely wiped out by about 300 CE, had a few little resurgences. And for the longest time, they'd been teaching that class, looking at those texts, as if there's no way anyone today would ever believe this stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And someone in California started a Gnostic church.
Wow. I have no idea.
I heard something recently, and I haven't been able to substantiate it, that there's apparently an ex-Muslim Christian church in California.
That is amazing. That's like Jews for Jesus.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know what it's about. Like, a friend of mine mentioned that her parents are attending it. I haven't looked it up or figured it out on my own if it's actually true or not.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, it's something to look up. I think Mohammed, I don't know if you've gotten it, but we've definitely had ex-Muslims who've converted to other religions who unfortunately who've tried to, you know, come into our space, and as much as it's their, you know, their life, their beliefs, it's fine. It kind of puts us in an odd position because, you know, we don't personally we just don't have a space for non-theist, you know, ex-Muslims. And if you convert to another religion, you end up in the community of other religions.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I think a lot of them don't realize that. People who don't believe in any god whatsoever, they don't have a place to go, and it's kind of tough turning people away. They haven't
the
been
concern.
Very happy about that.
The concern we have is if, like, we're a non-theistic group. We have mostly agnostics and atheists and the odd deist. Is if you have somebody that has actively converted from Islam to Christianity or to another religion, chances are that they will be butting heads with our members. And when you're creating a safe space where people are trying to get away with all that stuff that they have to deal with 29 days of the month, you don't want to bring that atmosphere back into that as well.
Yeah. Well, a good example of that, I'm part of a ex-Adventist group on Facebook that about half the members of that group are Christian, the other half are atheists, and it's supposed to be about sharing how you left the Adventist church and, you know, helping people adjust to life outside of that community. And for the most part, it ends up just being arguments over whether or not there's a God.
Exactly. We do not want that. Ours are basically, okay, we've moved past God. What do we do now?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a thing we try to avoid.
Have there been much tension in your groups between Shia and Sunnis?
Oh my God, I don't. It's
that's like
I don't. I have no. I don't see why, and I don't. We haven't, thankfully. And sorry, Mohammed, go ahead.
Less than you'll have between Next Generation versus original series Star Trek.
Just awesome. A good razzing, nothing too serious.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Good.
Excellent. That is awesome to hear that people are able to get past their childhood differences like that.
Yeah.
It's more points where you can make fun of, like, okay, you have 20 more points than we have about how stupid that was.
But yeah, I'd imagine that'd be like atheists who used to be Christian. It's not like you're going to get into a fight because you came from different churches.
No, that doesn't typically happen, does it?
If somebody's from a Pentecostal, they'll have more stories to tell you than if somebody is from a different...
Best I've gotten was a fun game of whose prophet was crazier.
I don't know. Who do you guys think? I think Muhammad tops it. I don't really know. Unless you guys have something that can top him, I don't really know.
I was going to say the Mormons or the Scientologists.
No, Joseph Smith was a con man.
Yeah, exactly.
Not crazy. Sure. Straight up con man.
Wait, who had the magic underwear?
That's Joseph Smith.
That's the Mormons.
And the Mormons.
Oh, okay, right.
I would have to go with Ellen White, the Adventist prophet.
I don't know.
She literally was brain damaged and was most likely suffering from epileptic seizures that were causing her visions. She was quite literally insane.
I wouldn't be surprised if that were true for a lot of these people.
Yeah.
Like Muhammad did have epileptic fits. I don't know if they were put on like him, like putting on a show if they were actually, he had a condition.
I heard about that. Him having cold sweats and
exactly
even on the hottest days.
So he may have a medical condition that caused some brain activity.
Hmm.
But then again, so did Paul on the road to Damascus, as I recall.
So, unfortunately, we don't have a time machine to go back and look at their brain scan. So, yeah.
Or actually assess their situation by modern psychology.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fun? How many of our leaders and prophets would be put into straitjackets nowadays?
So if you look
hopefully
at it,
hopefully they'd be treated then put into straitjackets. But
yeah, medication would take care of most of them.
Okay.
If you look at it though, like Muhammad married a 6-year-old and had sex with a 9-year-old. He had 11 wives. He attacked random caravans, things of that nature. Jesus claimed to be the son of God. Abraham tried to kill his kid. Noah, apparently, the entire world was going to die. I'm sure all of them would have gotten medication if they existed today.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That is so
could you
true.
Give us a quick, a little telling of like what the Hadith are and
so,
are they important? I mean, like their rules, essentially, or sayings.
So basically, Seth, you want to take it or should I?
Oh, just basic thing. They're pretty similar to the Gospels. There were recordings of Muhammad's preachings and the things that he said and he done. But they typically, a lot of people say that they're only Quranists, meaning that they only go by whatever's in the Quran. The Hadiths, however, it's a little odd because I think Muhammad, I think you can correct me here, but how to pray, the traditional way 5 times a day, that's actually outlined in the Hadiths, which I'm not sure if a lot of Muslims know about that, but they say that they only believe in what's in the Quran, but the customary, you know, the traditions and the things, the customs that they do actually come from the Hadiths.
Isn't there something like overall 300,000 that are recorded, but only 10,000 are said to be truly accurate?
So basically what happened was after Muhammad died, the Quran was compiled within a few decades, so it's relatively close in time. The Hadith are basically what people heard Muhammad say kind of thing, but they were compiled around 2 centuries afterwards. So you have 2 centuries of Chinese whispers going on, and the way they quote-unquote verified them, they had multiple guys wandering around the Islamic world, which was pretty huge at that point in time. And if anybody mentioned that Muhammad had said X, Y, and Z, they wrote it down. And then they went and tried to ask people around town that, is this person an honest person and were his parents honest people? And if they were honest people, they wrote it down. If not, they discarded it. After that, they went home and they prayed to God to guide them for each one. And if they had a pleasant dream, they wrote it down. If they had a bad dream, they didn't write it down.
Wow.
So that's how it was originally compiled. And a lot of Islamic jurisprudence comes from those Hadiths. And according to them, quote unquote, there's a science behind it, but that is what the science is, what I just outlined. And there are a lot of outrage. So there's one, for example, where if you drink the urine of a camel, you'll be cured of a variety of diseases. There's one about if there's a fly in your drink, make sure to dunk it thoroughly, because one wing of a fly has disease, the other will have the cure for the disease. there's things like there's insanely immoral. So, for example, I would mention before that sex slavery is allowed in Islam. So when you have a war, you capture prisoners of war. And there was multiple of these women were raped. So they come to Muhammad and ask him that we're raping these women and we don't want them to get pregnant. So we're pulling out. Is that okay? And Muhammad responded that it's not okay because conception is with God. So rape is perfectly fine. Just don't pull out. So all of this comes from the Hadith.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. There are a little more bizarre things in there too. I think there is actually one of the Hadiths, which I always thought was kind of odd, where a woman who came, she asked about her daughter, and her daughter was sick and she was losing her hair. And they asked the Prophet if it was okay if she wore a wig, and he said no. So I guess it's a little odd that a lot of Muslims now today, you know, wear, you know, hair extensions, normal things, or if they, you know, they have to go through chemotherapy, you know, they wear wigs. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's, but, you know, guess there wasn't chemotherapy back then. They couldn't wear wigs back then. So, I don't know. So, there's a lot of crazy treasures in there.
Well, just like Christianity. I mean, most Christians eat shellfish, even though they're not supposed to.
Right.
And besides, you know, some silks look really good with a poly blend. You know, just...
I don't remember the exact of these, but there's hadith about that as well. Like, men are not allowed to wear silk because it makes them effeminate. And, like, there's allusions about homosexuality being horrible, and therefore gold and silk are forbidden on men.
Hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right, one question I've got to ask, since with my Adventist background, I had similar things I couldn't eat and couldn't drink alcohol. How are you guys liking beer and bacon?
Or have you partook?
Bacon is great. I've still not developed a taste for beer. I'm more of a liquor, rum, vodka, tequila.
Nice. I'm more of a cider person. And I drink hard liquor. So it's, yeah, beer is not a big thing for me. But bacon's cool. I like, you know, honey glazed ham. That stuff is cool. I like that stuff. But growing up in Canada, it was fairly normal for me to be around it, and I was never really disgusted by it. But actually, a lot of ex-Muslims do have a very hard time eating pork because it's just embedded in their brain that it's a disgusting thing to eat. And the smell, a lot of them, I've been told that makes them very nauseated. So unfortunately, pork's not for everyone.
I find that pork chops sometimes will make me a bit sick to my stomach.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy talk, man.
The rest of it I'm fine with, though.
I agree about the crazy talk part. Yeah. But generally, like, if you've been told since you're a child that this is the most disgusting animal that is possible, and this animal lives in a horrible way, like from the perspective of eating anything or eating feces, and all these diseases happen and whatever, like, and it's ingrained in every...
They don't have enough, or they don't have as many stomachs as cows, right? So there isn't that proper filtration process. I've heard the weirdest propaganda about pigs. But pigs are such cute animals. I don't know why they have something against them. Anyway.
Wow. That's
the same thing for dogs, though. They're an unclean animal also.
Yeah. So basically, I think in Islam, if you have a dog in the house, apparently angels won't come to visit you. Right. And my brother and I, we got a dog not too long ago, and my parents had a huge fit. So my parents said that, you know, well, my dad specifically, he's like, if there's dog hair in the house and then it's on my clothes and I go to pray, and you have to be apparently very clean, you know, before every prayer, you have to do what's called a wudu. So you know, it's like a ritual cleansing with water. And, you know, if there's dog hair or any other things like, you know, nail polish or makeup, or any, if you have any scents on you, like perfume, then your prayer is, it's null, it's void. So for a lot of Muslims, you know, they're told pretty much, yeah, dogs are just the devil. They're just, keep them out of the house. You can keep them on the street, but you can't have them in the house. So, yeah. But my dad eventually got used to the dog. He feeds the dog at the dinner table now. So he's very charmed by the dogs.
Then the other way that I heard that Muhammad actually really liked cats.
Yeah. I guess, I don't know why, but I guess he liked cats. Muhammad, do you know anything about that?
No, I do not. But on the other hand, I do know that cats are big in the Muslim world. Mm-hmm.
There was something about, like, instead of waking a cat up, Muhammad cut the sleeve of his shirt off so that it could still lay there when he had to leave or something like that.
I can actually respect that.
Yeah.
I'd say wake it up and get your sleeve.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so he had a really big respect for cats. He would have been a good Redditor, I think.
I don't know. He would have done all of his sayings with cat pictures.
The best ones are.
Mm-hmm.
So, what plans? What are you guys working on? Got any like a convention or any big groups or?
So currently, we're working on expanding. Like, so our primary thing is providing safe spaces for ex-Muslims. So we're hoping to set that up in every major city. We're working on that primarily at the moment. We're also trying. So one of the problems with that is that most, as I was mentioning, if you leave Islam, you tend to keep it to yourself, you tend to stay away from anything that would cause controversy. So it's very hard to reach out to ex-Muslims that are out there. So that's why we're trying to raise our profile as a group. So for example, like, we had one person that lives in DC and actually lives like 2 miles from where I live. And she left Islam like years ago and never knew that the word ex-Muslim exists, or there's the whole concept was foreign to her. And she was reading some blog and the word ex-Muslim popped up and she Googled ex-Muslim and found us. And then came to our meetup, and she, after like 5-6 years, she discovered the word. So even the word is not that common. So what we're hoping to do is, work with secular groups and, establish a presence in the media and stuff to enter the zeitgeist, if you will, where ex-Muslim, the concept of an ex-Muslim, the concept of our existence is accepted and, talked about. And that'll allow other ex-Muslims to come out and talk about their experiences.
Excellent.
So, like, we've started a blog role, www.exmuslimblogs.com, where we have a bunch of ex-Muslim authors that are writing. We're working on, but haven't gotten to that stage yet. We'll probably have a podcast set up within the next few months as well, with specifically ex-Muslim people participating.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
How about, like, the clergy project? Are you familiar with that?
I've been in contact with... I think Catherine Dunphy, who is based out of, in Canada, I believe. I'm not sure if is it both in Canada and the States?
I don't know. I know is the project that Daniel Dennett started, where like a clergy that don't believe they're able to help them get out of that life.
I would imagine Canada would be included.
Yeah. No, I've been in contact with one so far. We are trying to reach out to other groups as well, humanist and secular groups. Mostly to sort of create a dialogue and discourse. And a lot of people are curious about ex-Muslims. And unfortunately, there aren't many people out there who, you know, who feel comfortable enough to go and speak about it. And for a lot of secular and humanist groups, it's sort of a tough topic to broach, especially if you don't come from the background, you don't know much about it. And we do find a lot of hesitation, which, you know, it's fully understandable.
I touched on this on the secular.fm thing, is that a lot of people are hesitant about criticizing Islam, and if they do, they get a lot of hate as a result. And the thing is that you have a lot of people that are bigoted that are attacking Muslims, and criticism coming from within is easier. I would say that it's harder to dismiss. I'm from Pakistan, so that's from Afghanistan. We have people from Libya, from Saudi Arabia, from the UAE. If we are speaking out specifically about Islam, it's very hard to pin it down as we are bigots. Muslims prefer not to actually confront the issues behind it. The West hates Muslims. The West has a problem with Muslims. When we're talking about it, they can't use that excuse. One of the other things is that often, I'm not sure where the term originated, but Islamophobia is a common term that's used for bigotry, which makes it harder to criticize Islam, because any criticism of Islam is regarded as Islamophobia.
Yeah.
We prefer using the term Muslimophobia, which is phobia of Muslims, of a people. Islam is an idea. You cannot be phobic of an idea. We're perfectly, everybody should be perfectly fine with criticizing and critiquing any idea, no matter what it is. That's one of the founding principles of America.
Yeah.
One of the things that we're trying to do is to push the word Muslimophobia, and like we're also, I myself have had experiences where after 9/11 and even recently where people have basically told me to go back to my country. You can't distinguish between an ex-Muslim and a Muslim. You can't, like, if you're from South Asia or if you're from the Middle East, you look similar. And there's a, that
or at least that's bigot- the idea that people hold. But anyway, sorry, continue.
The issue of bigotry really exists, and we do need to work against that. So we need to have a term specifically to address that issue. So on our website, we have an About Us segment where we have some details on our approach on that, that we will not tolerate bigotry from anybody. On the other hand, we will not tolerate apologetics either, where simply because some people are bigoted, therefore your ideology cannot be challenged, period. Islam as an ideology can and should be challenged like any other ideology out there.
The big benefit you have over, say, Wesley or I challenging the ideology is you have the knowledge base where we don't. And it's, if you're speaking from ignorance, it's really easy to end up saying really stupid, bigoted stuff. And so a lot of us just keep our mouths shut.
Well, hopefully we will fill that gap, and we would love your help in that as well.
Yes.
And I wouldn't say like keep your mouth shut in the sense of there are legitimate criticisms regardless. And a good chunk of criticisms that you would make of Christianity are the same criticisms you'd make of Islam as well, like regard rationality and dogma. And even a lot of theology is shared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and you know, like on our show, we do, we'll take up stories that deal with Islam and Muslims and address issues that are very clear ones, like women's rights and gay rights and freedom of religion and the like.
Yeah.
Right.
Man. Mohammed, how old were you when you came out to your parents?
I was 27, 28.
So your family as a whole, though, they basically know and are pretty much okay with it?
Yeah, exactly. My family is very liberal compared to the average. And so one of the defining things is my mother is very liberal. She's more liberal than my siblings. And her primary concern was alcohol more than religion. So there have been cases where my siblings have attacked me over my faith and lack of faith, if you would. And she's defended me that we each have our own path and our own journey and things of that nature.
Has anybody in your family come out to you to be a non-believer also after that?
Cousins, yes. Two of my cousins.
Nice.
And it's helped them. So one of my cousins is younger, and her family obviously took it very, very badly. But the fact that she had my example already out there helped her a lot, like to diffuse the tension and issues that she had to go through. So there are a few other things that I'd like to talk about before we wrap up.
Definitely.
Go for it.
So regarding in the UK, they've been working on this for a lot longer, and Muslim presence is a lot stronger. So there are issues that they have encountered that are now coming up over here. So I don't know if you heard about the gender segregation issue that they had last year and early this year. So it has popped up a few places in Canada. We haven't seen it in the US as well yet, but like issues like that will happen wherever you have a large community of people that believe that gender segregation is the right thing to do. So it's essential that we keep an eye on things and make sure that that's not allowed. In the UK, for example, they also have religious courts that are now sanctioned to a certain extent, and where Muslim people can voluntarily go and get civil judgments passed by a religious scholar. And that usually ends very, very badly because the religious scholar is relying on texts that are deeply misogynistic.
Mm-hmm.
And it
works great for you if you're male.
As a man, I disagree.
It typically works against you.
Mm.
I find, any sort of segregation, you end up having these very odd thoughts about, for example, the opposite sex, the more segregated you are, you know, but it's disturbing to hear that even women, feel that gender segregation is okay because they feel that they're partly responsible for whatever thoughts that they put into another person's head. And I think that it's the whole idea, this sexism, this misogyny it's sadly perpetuated by women themselves. But sadly, I don't think they realize it. But anyway,
there's an inversion of responsibility where in Islam, the male drive is the women is responsible for controlling that because men are animals.
Yeah,
that's the entire reason for the burqa, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Even with the hijab, it's still a hijab nowadays. I think it's a little more symbolic. It's a little more complicated issue, I feel. But it still does fall in line with the modesty doctrine.
And to clarify the distinction for our listeners.
Oh, yeah, burqa. Burqa is typically, it's just a full covering. The only thing that's visible is your eyes. And some burqas, there is like a netting where the eyes are. Sometimes some women can barely see. With a niqab, however, there's like a veil that you put on that separates your eyes. So it's like a wide, like a little opening for your eyes. And a hijab is just a headscarf where your face is fully visible.
But your hair, the distinction is any hair should not be visible.
That's correct. And your neck.
And arms and legs and.
I heard there were some women that actually would shave their heads and to try and get around that so they didn't have to wear a hijab.
Frankly, I don't know anyone that's done that before. I guess that might be a more of a rare thing.
Yeah. That would be theologically accurate. You're not showing hair, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, just think about what I've seen in Boise. It's mostly been the hijab. Mm-hmm. Once or twice, I've seen a full burqa. Mm-hmm.
I just don't, I could not, I can't wrap my head around that. Being in a Middle Eastern country, so if you're actually wearing like a burqa, which is like, to me, it's like a body condom. You don't see, a person is wrapped and just hot. And
you're invisible. Your individuality, it's gone. You're just a person underneath this body bag. Yeah.
And women aren't wearing the white ones. That's just the guys, isn't it?
Usually, yes.
Yeah, typically. Typically, they're black, right? Mm-hmm. Like a dark color.
Oh, hell
nothing,
no.
Nothing a too desert, fancy.
Desert sun, and you're wearing a dark color.
Mm-hmm. So there are, theologically, there are hadiths that women are not allowed to go out. Women are not allowed to go out without a man present and things of that nature. So it does stem from actual theology. Mm-hmm. A lot of Muslims like to make excuses where it's a Saudi phenomena and stuff like that. But if you read the actual scriptures, the hadiths and stuff, they do lay out limits on what a woman can do and where a woman can go and the requirement of a man being there. So there are things about a woman cannot travel for more than a day. And if she does, she may be an adulteress and things of that nature without a man present, a guardian present, because a woman requires a guardian.
Mm-hmm. They're typically referred to as a mihram. It's usually the guardian would have to be a family member or someone that they can't have sexual relations with. Mm. And in mihram, you have the option to not wear for example, the hijab. You don't have to necessarily cover everyone around them because they can't be sexually attracted to you.
Father, brother, husband.
Yeah.
Eunuch?
Or children. I think, weren't eunuchs mentioned somewhere?
I have no idea. I haven't read that.
Okay.
So going back to the issues that we have over here is,
yes,
our members are often, you have social ostracization, you have physical abuse that we have had people go through, their death threats that people have gotten. But often one of the solutions that people have is they try to bundle kids off back to country of origin. Mm. And so you'll be forced into a marriage with somebody from a third world country. So, for example, we were talking to somebody and it's been put on the back burner, but we were worried that was going to happen where a Somali girl was being sent to Kenya to get married. Things of that nature do happen where people are forced into marriages because you're becoming too Western, because you have certain ideas that we cannot allow. And in America, there's no legislative protection for that, especially if somebody is underage. And that's something that we hope to work on down the road as well. Again, going back to the UK, they passed a law a few years ago called the Forced Marriage Act, where if it's discovered that a parent is trying to force a child into a marriage, the parents will go to jail for a 1 to 2 year period, and their custody rights will be eliminated.
Excellent.
They also have something where, if I read the article correctly, they can put, for example, like a metal spoon in their underpants, and when they go through a metal detector, they'll be pulled aside, and at that point they'll have the chance to let authorities know that, you know, I'm being taken by force. And I think that's one of the little safety measurements that they have. Hopefully there's something set up over on North America, Canada. Yeah, that's what we're hoping for.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's mind-boggling.
So, going back to the insular communities thing. So if you're, say you're a young girl or guy that is leaving Islam or whatever, and your family finds out and you're not in control. And if, generally speaking, if you're in a bad situation, you will go to your friend, you will go to somebody you trust. But if everybody is from the same culture, you've been, it's been made sure that all the people that you're surrounded by are people that agree with your parents, then it's very hard to get out of that situation. And in those cases, you're forced to, you have no outlet, you're taken on a plane and you're gone.
Mm. Damn.
Anyway, yeah, those are some of the things that we fear for. And honestly, I've heard of instances, friends of mine that, you know, have been taken back unsuspectingly, thinking that they're just going back for a visit. And I think that's one of the ways that they end up tricking them. And they end up being taken over to someone's home, and they introduce their new husband or new potential husband to. And that's many of the things that we were very afraid about. And I think we have many members who are afraid of going back to their, you know, their parents' home country or their own home country. And it does get a little bit scary sometimes.
Oh, hell no.
Yeah. Yeah, there have been instances. For example, one of our co-founders was actually, she helped someone out. I think it was Northern Africa, and helped this one young lady get back to her embassy because her parents actually held onto her passport and her identification and any sort of funds that she had. And so there are things like this that happen, and it's a real issue that I don't think many people are addressing.
And there's no legislative protection at all within either Canada or America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's an issue most people just don't know about.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I'm getting publicity for that. So it's a tough thing.
Yeah.
Man, this is quite enlightening. So what can we do to help? Is there anything we can do to help?
In terms of the ex-Muslim movement, I suppose, or?
Yeah.
Or in terms of speaking about Islam, one of the things... Muhammad, do you have any ideas? Actually, we're hoping to work with, the secular community, and giving that platform for ex-Muslims or people who can step forward and speak about these issues, without sort of any apology, talking about it in a very straightforward manner. It's tough. It does come best from people who come from these backgrounds. They tend to be more nuanced and their experiences and the way they speak about it. And I do find that I think as we addressed earlier, that a lot of people are afraid of coming off as bigoted. And that puts people in a really tough situation, because I think people are very afraid of offending, people of different backgrounds. It's easy for most people to, make any sort of joke about Christianity. No one's going to get a death threat for having a picture of Jesus. You know, the whole Jesus and Mo thing in the UK, that's a big thing over there. People do not like depictions of Muhammad, obviously. We do hope to talk to people about it.
Even with the Jesus and Mo cartoon or things like that, like South Park had an episode with Muhammad where it was censored. So we, the secular community, and I would say the larger American community, to stand up that freedom of speech is something inviolable. Even if it is offensive to certain people, we will not back down, regardless of what the origin or the reason for the offense is. And many, many times people have backed down in the face of that opposition. When the Danish cartoons incident happened in America, they were not republished in any newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
In recent news, the issue that happened with Majid Nawaz, the BBC actually did a special, in it, like a news segment, and they actually had the Jesus and Mo cartoon that was drawn. They actually had Muhammad blacked out.
Oh.
And it's amazing that, a reputable news source like that, they actually were afraid of offending people over a cartoon depiction.
Hmm.
You know, that's the direction things are going. It's kind of scary.
So, stepping back, like the wider context of that, Majid Nawaz is part of a think tank called Qiyam. And what they do is they're fighting against extremism in Muslim countries. And Majid Nawaz himself is a liberal Muslim. He is a Muslim. And he got death threats for simply tweeting that a cartoon cannot offend him.
Mm-hmm.
And newspapers in Pakistan printed that he should be murdered, and one newspaper actually had an article about how he should be murdered, eliciting responses, and readers responded on what's the best way to kill him.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, that is a Muslim person. That is not somebody that has walked away and is talking about it from the outside.
Holy crap.
So, if you look at it from that perspective, it's very hard for Muslims to stand up and fight back. And they need the support of the West to stand with them shoulder to shoulder to be able to make those changes happen.
It has to be a joint sort of collective to move forward and create some sort of a dialogue. I think it just can't be done by ex-Muslims alone. And I feel that not many people want to hear it coming from ex-Muslim people who have left the faith. So.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the issues that we've encountered as well, is that so if we ask, for example, you guys, that what do you identify as, you would say an atheist. Instead of that, if I were to ask you, why don't you identify as a ex-Seventh-day Adventist or an atheist Seventh-day Adventist or something of that nature, we have gotten feedback that why our name is so antagonistic. Why can the word atheist Muslim or the word cultural Muslim or any of those other words that will not offend Muslims?
Yeah.
And
but they really make it seem as if atheism is just a Western phenomena. Why can't we say that we're atheist? Why can't we say that we're ex-Muslim? What is so wrong with that? And having people tell us that it's antagonistic, it's very disheartening. It's kind of polarizing for us, especially when it takes a lot of courage to come out. Like, I feel uncomfortable giving people my full name, just saying that. The last thing I want to do is cause a disruption. I just want to show that it's okay to not believe in God. And I left Islam, and there are a host, there's probably thousands of people out there in the world, maybe in Muslim majority countries, who don't have the privilege to say that, hey, you know what? I have doubt, or I don't believe in God. And that's the tough thing. And when people say that, you know, you're very antagonizing. Having heard that from all types of people, whether it be from the secular community or even from Muslims themselves, you know, it's very polarizing, and it's difficult for us to counter that. That's one of the issues that I think that we face.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so much easier for me to say, yes, I'm an atheist, but I'm also culturally Christian. Mm-hmm. Just because I like presence.
It was insisted that you're supposed to be culturally Christian, and that is the label you're allowed to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I only say that because I like presents.
Well, everyone likes Christmas, but and Easter and chocolate, but, you know, on our end, I think that's another issue. What does it mean to be culturally Muslim? There are so many different types of Muslims out there. As an Afghan whose parents, you know, had to deal with, you know, Soviet invasion and communism and dealing, my parents were persecuted for being Muslim. My experience, or my parents' experience as Muslims, that's not comparable to what someone, for example, in Pakistan or in Indonesia or Malaysia or Morocco would face. Mm-hmm. So what does it truly mean to be a cultural Muslim? So that's one of the difficult things. We're not a monolith. Muslim or Islam is not a monolith. And you can't say that, you know, you can't put that, you can't corner us into this and say that we can't say that we're ex-Muslim. It's very tough.
Yeah.
So, and if you say that you're, you know, an ex-Christian or you're culturally Christian, same thing, you know, are you cultural Christian from Ethiopia? Are you from, you know, England? Are you, it's very different. It varies. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, someone to say culturally Christian in the U.S., the assumption would be American Protestantism.
Right.
But in Italy or in Ethiopia, that would be a very different thing.
Yes, it would.
Yeah.
And the Islamic experience is very diverse from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess denying us that diversity, I think that's another, that's something I definitely push forward, because it almost seems racist in itself, but even though people don't realize it, not that I'm calling everyone a racist, but it does imply that. So.
Yeah.
I think I covered that. Sorry for that rant. That's just something very recent that's been on my mind, and I just had to get it out.
So often related to that, we're asked why we chose the label ex-Muslim. So one of the reasons that Sadaf was mentioning was that to show solidarity with people that have left Islam in the Middle East, South Asia, and conservative Muslim countries. Another aspect is generally within Muslim communities, atheism is regarded as a Western phenomenon. Being an atheist is a Western fad. Being an ex-Muslim is far more visceral. You're rejecting Islam. You're explicitly saying that Islam isn't something that I used to believe in, but I no longer do. So in order to actually penetrate the community where they will reject it outright. So we've had people talk to us that we were never real Muslims to begin with. Because if you are a real Muslim, you believe in the truth. There's no way you can actually walk away. So we found that the label was very effective to convey where we're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Totally. I'm sure that's the easiest way to get your message across. It totally makes sense.
Absolutely. I think I actually wrote a blog post on it. It's in the ex-Muslim blogs. I'm going to plug it in. But is under the Murtad journals, and it's called The X and Ex-Muslim. And there I write a little bit of a spiel of, you know, my personal background. You know, the same reason that Muhammad just gave right now, as to, you know, to show a sense of solidarity. And this sort of work has been done before, and it's been addressed. However, it just hasn't gotten out there. I'm not talking about specifically about my work, but work from the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain, who for the how many of six plus years,
6 years.
6 years they've been working on similar things, but on the other side of the, you know, on that side of the globe. And I think it's time to really spread the message, and that's what we've been trying to do in North America, at least.
And that specific blog post of hers has been translated in multiple languages. We've seen it pop up in Indonesia and in multiple other countries.
Very nice. Awesome.
It's a little scary, but it's good. It's good.
Actually, is that something that you guys have worked on, is getting your site translated into other languages?
We're primarily addressing North America, so most everybody over here has been like English speaking. We're okay. working on Sadaf and a few other people are working on establishing in Quebec, where we will probably translate things to French, but we haven't worked on the rest of the world yet.
French doesn't matter.
Well, actually, right now, what's going on in Quebec is a little iffy. The charter that they're trying to pass, where there's no sort of showing, they're trying to ban any sort of religious symbolism on clothing. And really? It's causing a big debate, and a lot of people do find it's a little bigoted.
I've never heard of this.
Okay. It's something to look up, definitely. I'm not too well versed in it.
But this is a law that they're trying to put into Canada. I'm going to have to look this up.
Yeah, it's in Quebec, so it's a provincial law.
Oh, okay. Hmm. Okay.
Wow.
It's the Quebec Charter of Values, am I correct?
Charter of Values. Okay.
Yep.
Huh.
Bill 60, yeah. So it's trying to limit the wearing of conspicuous religious symbols. So, for example, a lot of people will have, you can't show the cross, like the cross, and you're wearing a necklace, a kippah, a turban. You're talking about the hijab, the niqab. There are a lot of, it's definitely not something that we agree with. Even as ex-Muslims, banning religious apparel, we believe that everyone should have the right to wear what they like. So, honestly, the one issue that we do definitely agree on is, for example, wearing the niqab, it does become a security issue. But other than that, we do believe people do have the right to wear what they like, religious or not. Because what's going to come next? People, you're going to start banning white face makeup and dark eyeliner, and goths aren't allowed to walk around. And, you know, it's sort of a bad spiral, I think.
Yeah. And it's kind of surprising to hear that coming out of Quebec, since, at least historically, it was a Catholic area.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to Quebec, there are a lot of different issues. For example, Quebec does have a history of wanting to preserve its culture, its French culture, right? That's only one of the aspects of it. But they do. Some people do say that it's because they want to protect people's, keeping religious, you know, trying to keep things sexy. So that's why they're trying to ban religious apparel.
And is that just for schools or is that everywhere?
I think that would be for everywhere. I think it's in public sector employees, I believe. I'm not sure if this would be in schools, but there have been issues with them, with some schools, I think, trying to ban a kirpan, which is a symbolic sort of customary sword or knife. It's like a wooden knife that Sikhs typically carry. There have been issues with that in the past, but I don't know how far this this bill sort of thing it covers, what sectors it covers, whether it's, you know, schools or, but it's definitely the public sector.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. It is the kirpan that the Sikhs carry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Crazy.
All right. Well, thank you.
Guys, thank you. This has been awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you guys could have us.
Thank you very much. It was great to be on the show.
Yeah.
Any links or anything else in particular to plug besides the Ex-Muslims of North America website?
We've talked about the blog, exmuslimblogs.com. We have our Twitter, which is @exmuslimsofNA. And we also have a Facebook presence, facebook.com/exmna.
All right. I'll get links to all those in the show notes.
Great.
Okay, awesome.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Sadaf, thank you. Mohammed, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Okay. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com. Contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zune, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.
Holy shit, you need to cut that. Holy shit, you need to cut that.
Get off the counter.
Wesley has cats.
Oh, he's got cats.